Très bien, je suis très heureuse d'accueillir ce soir le professeur Michael Detlefsen, professeur à l'Université Notre Dame, Indiana, dans le cadre de deux conférences qu'il nous fait l'honneur de donner, pour la première ce soir et pour la seconde le 20 octobre. Cette série de conférences est la conclusion que le Collège de France a souhaité donner pour sa part aux quatre années que le professeur Detlefsen a passé en France comme titulaire d'une chaire d'excellence intitulée « L'idéal de la preuve, Ideals of Proof », pour la création de laquelle le Collège de France avait été associé à l'Université de Nancy II et à celle de Paris 7, dans le cadre de la chaire de philosophie de la connaissance et du langage occupée par le professeur Jacques Bouvresse, qui ne pouvait malheureusement être présent ce soir et vous prie de l'en excuser. Il est inutile de présenter un philosophe aussi éminent que le professeur Detlefsen, qui est d'ailleurs déjà connu d'une bonne partie d'entre vous. Qu'il me soit simplement permis de rappeler que le professeur Detlefsen est entre autres activité éditoriale directeur du très réputé Notre Dame Journal of Pharmacology depuis 1984, je crois. Ses recherches ont porté principalement sur l'histoire et la philosophie des mathématiques, en particulier le programme de Hilbert et les conceptions formalistes en philosophie des mathématiques, la signification philosophique des théorèmes d'incomplétude de Gödel, le constructivisme ancien et moderne, Kronecker, Poincaré, Brouwer, etc. Un bon nombre de ses publications constituent plus ou moins des classiques dans ce genre de domaine. Au nombre des plus importantes figurent notamment Hilbert's programme, publié chez Riedel en 1986, la direction de deux ouvrages importants, Proof and Knowledge in Mathematics et de Proof Logic Formalization, 1992 chez Routledge. On lui doit aussi Philosophy of Mathematics in the 20th Century dans la Routledge History of Philosophy, le volume 11 de 1996, et Formalism dans les Oxford Handbook of the Philosophy of Mathematics and Logic, 2005, pour ne citer que quelques-uns de ces très nombreuses publications. L'objectif de la chaire d'excellence, Ideals of Proof, était, comme le voulaient leurs défenseurs, si j'ose dire, double. Le terme même d'ideals, au pluriel, devant s'entendre, selon eux, au moins en deux sens. Le premier sens ayant trait aux visées et aux vertus de la proof, preuve, selon qu'on les considère très généralement sous l'angle de ces normes de justification qui sont inhérentes à la pratique mathématique. Parmi ces idéaux, figurant non seulement des critères aussi traditionnels que la rigueur, la certitude, le critère a priori, la pureté, le gain explicatif, mais aussi des vertus plus systémiques telles que la complétude, sous ses différents types, la clôture, l'efficacité, ou la liberté. Ainsi entendu, l'objectif premier était donc d'améliorer la compréhension que nous pouvons avoir des raisons pour lesquelles de telles conditions, de telles contraintes ont pu, dans l'histoire des mathématiques, constituer des idéaux de la preuve, et de se demander aussi s'ils méritent bien d'être tenus pour tels. Mais « ideal » peut être pris en un second sens, qui a trait cette fois à l'utilisation que l'on peut faire de ces entités et méthodes idéales, comme l'introduction de nombres infinis et complexes en algèbre et en analyse, etc. Il s'agit donc, dans le projet, d'approfondir ces deux acceptions et de montrer aussi, et je crois que cela a été amplement démontré au cours des années où vous avez travaillé en association avec d'éminents collègues qui sont pour certains d'entre eux dans cette salle aujourd'hui, comment donc l'utilisation de ces idéaux pris au second sens peut contribuer ou non à une meilleure efficacité, efficiency, et à la réalisation des idéaux entendus au premier sens du terme. Comment, par exemple, cela peut-il affecter la rigueur, la pureté ou l'adéquation explicative que nous recherchons? Ou encore, quelles conséquences peut avoir l'admission de telles entités et méthodes idéales sur le rôle du raisonnement constructif dans l'épreuve. À quel type de liberté? C'est la troisième question, je crois, que vous avez essayé de vous atteler. Fait-on appel? Et quelle place est-on prêt à accorder à cette liberté dans la preuve et dans les autres formes de raisonnement mathématique? Quel est encore, quatrième enjeu de votre projet, le rapport entre l'utilisation qu'on fait de ces entités et de ces méthodes idéales et les différents idéaux de complétude ou de clôture? Enfin, quels effets peut avoir l'admission de méthodes idéales dans la preuve sur la logique même des notions de preuve, de prouvabilité en mathématiques? Plus généralement, il s'agissait donc de mieux comprendre en quoi a consisté dans le passé et en quoi peut encore consister à l'avenir la contribution de ces méthodes à l'entreprise plus vaste ou aux entreprises plus vastes que sont celles de la connaissance mathématique et de la preuve mathématique. Est-il besoin de rappeler enfin que les travaux effectués par le professeur Detlefsen sur des notions comme celles d'axiomatisation, de formalisation et de complétude, qui constituent donc bien un des axes du projet de la chaire d'excellence et qui sont aussi le sujet sur lequel il a choisi de se concentrer dans cette dernière série de conférences, ont une importance tout à fait considérable, qui est d'ailleurs déjà, sur le plan mondial, amplement reconnue. Je suis donc particulièrement heureuse et impatiente de l'entendre nous en parler ce soir, et je lui laisse donc sans plus attendre la parole.
Thanks a lot, Claudine, for that very kind introduction. Okay, and so this is very new work for me. It's not something I just started, but it's something I picked up again after having laid it down for a couple of years because I wasn't getting anywhere with it. It may have been a mistake. I don't seem to be getting anywhere very fast now either, but at least I should be able to present what I think are some pretty challenging problems that maybe come from surprising sources, what seemed like or could seem like offhand or off-the-cuff comments that people made about axiomatization. I actually think they weren't off-the-cuff at all. They were studied comments. So all of the comments I'm going to talk about today fall into that category. All right. So let's begin then by looking at a well-known passage from Gergonne, in which he talks about what I call, generally speaking, organizational ideals of science. He was really interested in duality, and more particularly in dual axiomatizations. And he thought that these were of particular interest because mathematics had grown so large that no one could master it without some sort of organizational help. And so he was commenting in this passage on two things. First of all, on axiomatization as a technique for organizing knowledge, and then more particularly on dual axiomatization as a means of organizing knowledge. So I won't read the whole thing out, but I'll read part of it. A science perhaps recommends itself less by the multitude of propositions which make it up than by the manner in which these propositions are related and connected to one another. So there he's emphasizing the importance of organization. He thought it was, broadly speaking, epistemological type of importance. Okay, so in other words, if we organize things right, our knowledge will somehow be advanced. Exactly how it might be advanced, we'll have to consider more carefully. All right. But he talked about the interconnection of beliefs. He talked about the special qualities that axiomatization had as a way of interconnecting beliefs. And then he mentioned one particular virtue that will be more or less the focus of my first talk in this series, and that's what I'm going to call compression or epistemic compression. He thought that the most important thing that was offered, especially in a high form, by dual axiomatization in projective geometry, was that it allowed one to embrace a great number of truths at a glance somehow. So some sort of summarization or condensation, or I call it compression. It was moreover a kind of justificative compression, but we'll say more about that in, as time goes on today. Okay. And he didn't give an example here, but he gave a general description of the traits that an example or any example he might have mentioned would have, and that is that the kind of organization, compression, condensation he was interested in was to be compared with some alternative that I call the instance by instance strategy or plan of justification. So if we have a set of propositions and we want to think about justificative strategies for that set of propositions, one strategy would be, a very simple-minded strategy would be to go through and justify all elements of the set element by element. Okay, he thought that that was a relatively poor form of organization. In fact, it was relatively no organization at all. And so he was looking for something that would improve on that. A plan for justifying a set of propositions that was more effective or more efficient, less costly in terms of resources that mattered, less difficult as a collective task, than the instance-by-instance approach to justification. Okay, and so I'm going to, this is just a terminology frame where I'm telling you what I'm going to refer to this supposed virtue that Guergon was interested in and aiming at and thought was realized in a high form by a dualized axiomatization. All right. Well, he wasn't the only person who talked about this, of course. And so, in fact, it's we could spend days looking at examples. We won't do that. I've got three or four, though, that I think are worth our time taking a look at. Here, Bossu talks about the importance of smallness of size in a set of axioms. Now, this is something that you've doubtlessly all read many times, how axiomatization is somehow better when the number of axioms is small. And that's supposed to be, I mean, you might think, well, yes, as a kind of measure of the skill or knowledge of the axiomatizer, that might be an excellence. It would take more skill, more knowledge, perhaps, to axiomatize a set of propositions using a small number of axioms than using a larger number of axioms. But is it, in fact, not just a virtue bespeaking an excellence or a command of some sort on the part of an organizer? Is it also, does it also constitute itself an organizational virtue? And the suggestion here is that it does. Okay. So, Comte talked a lot about the importance of organization in knowledge. And his view was that, here you'll see him talking, in fact, about this instance-by-instance strategy for justifying a set of propositions. He says it's essentially the task of science to dispense, so far as different phenomena permit it, with all direct observation. Because direct observation is a paradigmatic case of instance-by-instance justification. And so, according to Comte, the organizational purpose of science is to produce a justificative strategy that's an improvement on this instance-by-instance kind of justificative strategy. Okay. Okay, so, and then he speaks about compression here, unevenness to deduce from the smallest possible number of immediate data the greatest possible number of results. I think his use of the term data there is, however, significant. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Okay. And now, this is the last example I have. I wanted to show you that this isn't something that passed from view in the 19th century sometime. It continued well into the 20th century and continues, in fact, today. So Courant says there must be a number of statements called postulates or axioms which are accepted as true and for which proof is not required. That's what the organization of mathematical knowledge requires. From these, we may attempt to deduce all other theorems by a purely logical argument. If the facts, something like Comte's data, if the facts of a scientific field are brought into such a logical order that all can be shown to follow from a select number of, preferably small in number, simple and plausible statements, then the field is said to be presented in axiomatic form. But then this striking remark, but that won't avail much unless the number of axioms is small. Okay, so you can see this is kind of a haunting refrain. Keep the number of axioms small. Most everyone who talks about axiomatization and its virtue in the last 200 years has emphasized something like that. So anyway, as I read this passage, and actually the larger passage of which it's a part, what's being said here is that the value of an axiomatic compression is, in some sense, proportional to its tightness. Okay, the degree to which it compresses some body of knowledge. And the factors he names that contribute to tightness are the size of the set of axioms, the individual simplicity of those axioms, and then their relationships of independence. Okay, so somehow these are three things then that contribute to tightness of axiomatic organization, the idea being that the tighter the organization afforded, the better the axiomatization. Okay, so if you go over and you look at salient points from those remarks, I think you come up with this list of six. You could make it a bit longer if you tried hard enough, but this will do. This is more than actually I'll be able to talk about today anyway. The first one is that justificative compression is a prime aim of mathematics. Now, mind you, of course, I haven't said anything about what this compression stuff is. Okay, I've just attached that terminology to these remarks that we've looked at, all right? And that's all at least I think I've done. I don't believe I've said anything informative about it yet. Secondly, that axiomatization is a prime means of effecting this desirable, primely desirable compression. Thirdly, compressing axioms are often more readily justified than the elements of the set of instances they compress. Okay, maybe the gear going went by a little bit too fast for that to have sunk in. Okay, that last colored portion of the sentence there. All right. So something's much simpler. The compressing axiom is somehow much simpler, much easier to justify than would be the justificative task of doing something else, in particular, of going through all of the subsumed instances one by one. Okay. So you see what's taking shape here, I hope, that I'm going to be treating this notion of compression as a kind of relationship between what I've referred to as justificative strategies. Okay, and so if one justificative strategy for a given set of sentences offers some sort of advantage of the sort that Gergonne and these others have talked about over another strategy, then we'll say that the one strategy compresses the other. Okay. I've got to quit doing that or I'll get lost. Okay. Right. Fourthly, that compression is worth pursuing even if it leads to lengthier, more complex proofs of theorems. I found this a really striking thing, and I thought, there probably is nobody else who said that. But that's wrong. Actually, there are a number of people who've said that thing. Now, I think this is important because here's an example of someone who thinks that this compression stuff really matters. Okay, it matters enough that even if axiomatization lengthens and complicates proofs, it's better to have it than not to have it. Wow, so now you have to be getting interested in this compression business. What is it that could be so good about this compactification that could overcome a disadvantage of this sort? Okay. Fifthly, that compression is better the tighter it is. That's not so surprising, I suppose. And lastly, that the tightness of compression depends on these factors that Gergonne, Comte, and Courant mentioned: relative sizes of the compressing and compressed sets, the simplicity of the individual elements of the compressing set, okay, and the mutual independence of these. Now, actually, I kind of started thinking about this when I was reading some old papers of Alonzo Church. They were on a topic that he referred to as irredundancy. These papers, he wrote two papers on this in 1926 and 1927. And irredundancy was supposed to be a more fine-grained form of independence. So Church was interested not only in whether you could derive one axiom for another, he wanted a way of talking about and even reckoning, or at least partially being able to measure, overlap between axioms that didn't completely overlap. Okay, overlap so much as the one to be derivable from the other. Okay, so he introduced this notion of irredundancy and wrote a couple of papers on it and then dropped it. He never went back to it. If you want the references, I'll be glad to provide them. So here's what I'm going to try to do then in the rest of the talk today. I'm going to, first of all, try to get clear on the nature of what I've referred to as justificative compression. All right? Now, I won't end up with anything that's terribly precise, but I think any progress here should be welcome, and I think I do make some progress. Secondly, I want to get clear on the relationship of compression to axiomatization. Okay, so if we know a little bit more about what compression is, then it would make sense to ask, what is it about axiomatization that produces this stuff? Okay, so I'm going to think about that some. Thirdly, I want to get clearer on what constitute significant increases or decreases in this property I've called the tightening of a the tightness of a compression. Okay, and lastly, I want to consider whether compression and or tightness of compression are maybe in competition with other ideals of mathematical knowledge, and more specific with other ideals of axiomatization. Okay. So for instance, I was thinking in particular of this suggestion that somehow a good axiomatization was worth having. It was better to have it than not to have it, even if it complicated proofs. Okay, so usually we think of simplicity of proof as some kind of an ideal of using proof as an implement of knowledge, all right. According to the author who said that, that's not entirely true. There are other virtues to be considered. And so I want to see if I can figure out a little bit more clearly what kinds of virtues might come into conflict with the virtues of compression or tightness of compression. Okay, and so then we'll begin with this, what I think is a key point of Guergaon, and that is this claim that seen from the elevated view, that is to say the view of an axiomatization, one realizes that the compressed instances, that is to say, the family of individual propositions that are covered by these axioms, okay, they stem from a common principle, the compressing principle, and then this striking remark, it's often incomparably easier to establish this compressing principle than it is the particular truths that constitute the instances of the principle. Okay, and so now you can see, I think, in this one little remark, the glimmer of a notion of compression, all right? An axiom, or what he calls a principle here, compresses its instances, okay, at least if you're talking about a view of those instances that has no alternative but to regard them instance by instance. Okay, so again, it's an organization of a family of propositions, all right, versus another organization, but a poor one, of a family of propositions. So I'm going to call this Guergaon's observation. Now, I think there are three different ways to understand what he's saying here. And you can see the influence of my life at Notre Dame in this kind of terminology. Unbelievable. I mean, I blush when I read it, but I couldn't think of any. I'm so ingrained in this way of doing things that I just use this terrible terminology. So the three views of this remark of Guergaon's, I'm going to call the self-evidential interpretation, the regressive understanding, and the demonstrative interpretation. So let's look at the self-evidential interpretation. Okay. So according to Guergaon, compressing principles can sometimes be self-evident. And when they are, their justification is easier, more readily available, less costly in terms of investigative resources than any instantial justification of their instances. Okay, so there's a kind of claim of efficiency or effectiveness here, that one way of justifying a class of propositions is more efficient, less costly than some other. Okay, and when you have that relationship again, the former compresses the set of propositions it covers in comparison with the latter. Okay. So then by instantial justification of an instance of a generalization, this is kind of important and it's kind of subtle. It actually turned out to be hard to give something that seemed to be, to say something that seemed to be true about this. So when I speak of instantial justification, what I mean is justification that proceeds by whatever would count as the standard means of confirming instances, okay, of whatever type of generalization it is. And so, in fact, these practices might vary from field to field. Okay, so all this is some sort of invocation of what would count as engaging in the practice of confirming an instance in whatever science it is that we're talking about. Okay, the important thing is about instantial justification is that it makes no appeal whatever to the compressing principle and sees the instance that's being confirmed as an instance of that principle. It does not do that. Okay, you can imagine that it's, if you want to anthropomorphize here, you could imagine it's blind. Okay, so I hand a logic student an example of excluded middle. Okay, this is a person who's a firm believer in the virtues of the empirical approach to things, doesn't care about its form, sees two sentences, decides to conduct an experiment to see whether one of those is true, and it turns out to be true. Okay, now he's verified an instance of excluded middle, but we certainly wouldn't say that he's verified it as an instance of excluded middle, okay, at all. But this is what instantial justification can come to. It doesn't justify by dint of some relationship it sees obtaining between a covering principle and the instance being verified. It does not do that. It just takes a more direct approach to the verification of the instance. Well, that's what I'm calling, generally speaking, instantial justification. So that was the self-evidential variant of Gergonne's remark. I use what I call a regressive interpretation, that even when a compressing principle is not self-evident, remember now the remark by Gergonne was that these principles that subsume these large classes of instances can be incomparably easier to justify than the instances themselves. Okay? So that could be because they're self-evident, but what about if they're not self-evident? Okay. Well, even when a compressing principle is not self-evident, it may be assertable because it has been confirmed by sufficiently many instances of some sort. Okay. Now, that represents a little bit of luck. All right. I mean, if I have this principle and I decide, okay, I'm going to test this, and I trot out a bunch of instances of it, and check those against whatever information sources I think are relevant. And it turns out to be right in every case. After a certain number of such cases, I'll be entitled rationally to assert the principle. And it would be silly to suppose that I'll have to go through all the instances before I reach that point. Okay, well, no, if I'm fortunate enough to pick instances that I'm able to verify, then I'll be able to exploit what knowledge I have at my disposal to actually elevate and extend my knowledge. I mean, that's the essence of induction. Okay. So that's one way then of looking at it. I mean, he could be saying what makes it easier is that you don't have to look at every instance. That's what the instantialist has to do. But you don't have to do that because you might find, even if you take an instantialist approach, you might find before walking the whole instantialist mile that you've got all the evidence that you need for your purposes. Okay. So, and last but not least, the demonstrative alternative. A compressing principle that is neither self-evident nor regressively justified might be justified by a proof. And it might be that that proof that justifies the principle is somehow less difficult, less costly to obtain than any instantialist justification of the principle. That is to say, a complete instantialist justification, one that goes through all the instances. Okay? But it wouldn't even necessarily have to go through all the instances. It might be that any portion of a full instantialist justification that would be capable of sustaining the assertability of the principle would require greater cost, greater effort of some sort to establish than would establishing whatever the subsuming principle for P is. That could happen. I'm just pointing out broadly logical possibilities here. Okay. So now let's talk a bit. I think we're ready to say something clearer about justificative compression. And so I distinguish three different claims here, and I think each of them clarifies in a certain way. First is that the justification of a principle P, whether it's self-evidential, regressive, or demonstrative, could furnish a more feasible and less costly means of justifying a set of instances, sigma P, than would instantial justification of sigma P. That's not guaranteed, but it could happen. Okay. If so, and if there wasn't a sacrifice in quality, justificative quality, okay, then I think the non-instantial justification of P would be said to provide a justificative compression of that set, sigma P, with respect to its instantial alternative. Okay. And more generally now, if then a given plan, what I'm calling a justificative plan for the justification of a set of propositions, is a compression with respect to all its alternatives, then we'll just say simply and unqualifiedly that that plan yields a justificative compression for that set of propositions. Okay, I mean, I just wrote this out so you can see where the quantifiers are. So, okay. So now let's talk a bit about the nature of compression, what it is. That was a characterization of when compression occurs. It gives you an idea of what I think compression is. It's this relationship between justificative strategies with respect to a given set of propositions. Okay? But really, what's its nature? Well, I think it's constituted by a reduction in the difficulty and or cost of a justificative task without a sacrifice in the justificative quality of the product. Okay. And so I want to say that if you accept this, that the goal of compression is to maximize epistemic productivity, and that means to maximize a certain ratio. Okay, and here's the ratio. Okay, so you take the value of the total epistemic product that results from applying what I call a justificative plan or strategy to a set. Okay, and then you compare it with the primitive epistemic resources that were needed in order to operate or put that plan or strategy into operation. Okay, if the total product exceeds what you needed in order to get the total product, then there's been a gain of some sort, and I take that as a kind of measure of the justificative compression, all right, of the strategy we're talking about. All right. Now, I want to remind you, I mean, you probably haven't forgotten, but just to make sure you haven't, we're talking about what people mean when they say you should keep the set of axioms small. All right. What are they thinking of? What could they possibly be thinking of? Okay. I'm moving towards a proposal here about what is meant by that. I think they mean something having to do with epistemic or justificative compression. And now I want to think about compression in a little bit less abstract way. So far I've been just treating the notion abstractly, but I want to think about now is if I was after compression, if I wanted to produce compression of this justificative sort, what type of axiomatization would I most prudently use to try to produce it? Or you could put the question a different way. How can you hope, what rational expectation have you of obtaining justificative compression through invocation of an axiomatization? Okay. Well, so I worked on this for a while, and I found it pretty frustrating. And I got less frustrated when I saw there's a real need for a distinction here between two very traditional things, one I call a synthetic axiomatization and the other an analytic axiomatization. And all of you guys will know basically what I'm thinking about there. Okay. But it's still, I'll go ahead and give my general characterization of what I take us these two forms, broad forms of axiomatization to be. So I looked at the problem this way. I mean, one way of looking at the problem of knowledge is this. I've got a space of propositions to be known. God gives me evidence, a distribution of evidence over that set of propositions so that some of them are evident and some of them aren't. Okay, my task as a knower is to extend the evident nodes of the class as effectively as I can to cover the whole space. All right, that's really my challenge as a knower. Well, but I really do depend on God here now, don't I? Because if he distributed evidentness over deductively weak propositions, then I'm just going to be screwed. Okay, unless I've got some device at my disposal that allows me to really do something special, namely take logically weak propositions that are justified and extend their justification to logically stronger propositions. Well, that's called induction, of course. But one way of thinking or conceptualizing what's going on here is this. I might also get lucky. God might really love me and want to bless my knowing, all right? And because of that, when he distributes evidence across the propositions in my world, all right, he puts high self-evidentness on a bunch of really strong propositions. And then my task is cake, right? I mean, unless I'm really bad at logic, all right? So, I mean, one way of looking at our situation, it could even be a predicament, as knowers is this. This is the way life is. There are natural sources of evidence. That's what we have to start with, okay? How much our knowledge can be developed depends on things like the logical power and the inductive patterns that exist in this set, or that we can find within the set anyway, okay? So a synthetic axiomatization represents a case where self-evidentness and logical strength coincide. Okay, so they converge there, all right? And then there are rich possibilities of justificative development. Okay. I'm employing the synthetic analytic terminology just to follow tradition terminologically here. Okay, so if you want to be reminded of where this came from here, here's a quote from a classical source, and there's a quote from a much less classical source, but a really good source because it represents a kind of distillation of mid-19th century understanding of what synthetic reasoning was. Okay. You've noticed that I like to read dictionaries. Okay. Now, how about analytic axiomatization? Well, that starts from the less favored initial position, where evidentness is distributed across relatively logically, deductively weak propositions. And then what I have to do, I may have to really work. I'll have to collect instances. I'll have to know something about relations of logical form between the evident propositions and the ones that aren't evident. And I'll have to know something about how to conduct inductive reasoning in a rational and responsible way. Okay? If I know those things, I still have some chances of developing, of justificative development. Gotta hurry up here. Okay. So, again, following the just established terminology, there's Pappus on what analysis is, and you can see that, you can see now why I call analytic axiomatization analytic. Here's a well-known remark of Russell's from this talk that he gave to the Cambridge Mathematical Club on the regressive method of discovering the premises of mathematics. So I'm just sure, in fact, I spent a little bit of time at McMaster looking in the archives, and I spent even more time talking about guys who know those archives well. I'm just sure, after reading this and 200 other remarks of Russell's, that he was thinking of things in just this logical space kind of way that I am. He was thinking, my goodness, what if I step into a world where the possibilities of knowledge have an initial distribution of evidentness only over weak propositions? And what if that happens, in fact, in mathematics? What would my fate as a mathematical knower be? Well, he answers here, and he gives an optimistic answer, okay? And in fact, he says, that's not just possibly the predicament, that is the predicament when we're talking about these big, powerful axiom systems he called foundational systems, okay? Now, those things, those axioms are too powerful to be very evident. How are we going to gain knowledge of them? Then, well, we'll employ a regressive strategy. All right, and in fact, he said, that not here, but in other writing more than once, that optimal evidentness occurs somewhere in the middle. Okay, now he didn't mean most evident, he meant optimal evidentness. You can get most evidentness at the level of the weakest propositions, but they're just not useful, okay, because they're so logically weak. What you want is a distribution of high evidentness across some constellation of propositions, which at least collectively give you some considerable, at least inductive, basis for ratcheting up your knowledge to a principle. Okay. So that's more or less what he's saying here, that we tend to believe the premises, the big mega principles, because we see their consequences instead of believing the consequences because we know the premises to be true. So he thinks this is the actual situation when it comes to foundational axiomatizations. Okay, so now there are all kinds of questions that are raised by this distinction of two broad types of axiomatizations. I'll start with some questions that arise in the context of what I've called analytic axiomatization. Okay, and they concern the disposition of a class of propositions I call D for something like data, all right? And the primitively evident propositions which serve as the evidence for H, okay? So that's why I call them data. They're the primitively evident propositions. We've got our space, D, or the elements of the space that bear the big E for evidentness, okay? So whatever evidence we're going to be able to get for principle is going to have to come from there, okay? And now the question arises, all right, so suppose we're lucky enough to get that. I can induce H from D, and I can see that all instances of D follow deductively from H. So does H, should you think of H as compressing D? Okay, now why should I be pausing so pregnantly over that question? Well, because remember, what I've been calling compression tracks what? It tracks evidentiary sources is what it does. Okay, and so if the evidence I have from H, for H, comes from D, then I can't dispense with the elemental justification of the instances of the elements of D. I can't, because then I lose H. Okay, so H doesn't really seem to compress D because it's not a justificative alternative plan or strategy for justifying the elements of D. It's not. Now we've got to do that from some independent source. Okay. And so then, what are the compressive possibilities for a regressively produced axiomatization, what I've been calling an analytic axiomatization? Well, it may do some compressing, but it doesn't compress the whole theorem set. So now there's a structure of compression that's beginning to develop that we'll have to consider before we can really talk about it in an accurate way. And it's even more troublesome because once I've seen that my possibilities for justifying H are limited more or less to this regressive or analytic strategy, then I'm motivated actually to let D grow because I get more evidence for H. So there then, the uncompressible part of the theorem set, I have a rational motive to let grow. That's kind of like saying, I have a rational motive to not compress part of the theorem set. Okay. So whatever kind of value of axiomatization is constituted by justificative compression, it's not a simple ideal. All right, not at all. It's relative to an axiomatic strategy, synthetic versus analytic, and it's relative to a bunch of features of the data set. Okay. Another thing that has to happen here is there's a kind of, the evidence that D provides for H gets better the more independent, in a certain sense, or a certain family of senses, the elements of D are. Because then they're really separate pieces of evidence. Okay, and so when I add an instance, I'm really getting more evidence. But I'm not, of course, if there isn't the right sort of independence relation between the existing tested instances in the new instance. So what I really have to do is to keep the elements of my data set apart. So not only don't I compress the theorem set as a whole, but there's one part of it that I not only don't compress, I kind of have to uncompress or decompress it. All right, I have to keep it from getting too compressed, because then it weakens the evidence I have for H. Okay, so this is just to say that I think compression is complicated. All right? It started innocently enough by somebody saying, keep the number of axioms small. All right? And now look what's happened, okay? When we try to figure out, well, why would that be something I ought to try to do as an axiomatizer? The answer is because you get this stuff called compression, and that is you get a big bunch of justificative bang for very little justificative buck. Okay, so it's a real deal. It's a real justificative deal. All right, but now I see, things don't work quite so well. They might work that way in synthetic axiomatization. Maybe that's the kind of axiomatization these guys who talk about small number of axioms were mainly thinking about. It would be odd if that was the case, because they were certainly, especially in the case of a guy like Courant, was certainly au courant. I mean, he knew about the hypothetical method in mathematics, and in fact, his teacher was a very well-known advocate of that. I'm sure he let his students know about it. Okay, so it's my view then that in analytic axiomatization, the axioms aren't intended to give a justificative compression of the whole of the theorem set, T. And in particular, they're not intended to compress D. Okay, and neither is minimization of number of primitive acceptances a primary goal. Okay, so remember now the crucial ratio was, we've got these primitive evidentnesses that come from God or nature or some other source independent of us, but it's where we start the knowledge game, all right? And so we're going to judge ourselves at the end of our epistemic lives by how much we were able to build on what we were given. All right, so we started with stuff we had no control over, and we did some stuff that we did have some control over, and if we were good enough at it, we got some more knowledge. Okay, and then kind of our efficiency as knowledge developers will depend on how much we built out of what we started with, all right? And if, to the extent that we added, to that extent, we compressed, in a sense. We compressed what we gained into what we started with, okay? That sounds like a kind of a red-blooded working man's way of looking at knowledge, right? I mean, emphasizes productivity, efficiency, skill, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so now I want to say just a bit about what it is we're counting when we're paying attention to what some people refer to as the number of axioms. Okay? Was it really something like numbers of propositions that mattered? No, it wasn't. It was rather this. It was number of distinct justificative acts that we needed to perform in order to cover a set with justification. All right? Now, maybe there's some correspondence between numbers of axioms and numbers of distinct justificative acts that are needed to produce such a covering, but maybe there's not. Okay? And so, I think that all of these people can be interpreted more plausibly, not as talking about really the literal size of an axiom set, but this more abstract, ethereal thing called the size of the rudimentary justification set. Okay. This is just my way of saying I didn't take them too literally. I took them pretty seriously. I mean, I've been talking for an hour. I mean, so enough to have something to say for an hour about this, but I didn't take them utterly literally. I did actually invest some effort into seeing if I could find a way to take them literally, and I'm convinced they're only foolish alternatives if you do take them literally. So I didn't. Let's see. Well, yeah, so let's now think ahead a bit. A couple of things I'll be talking about or wanting to talk about next time. Maybe you'll want to think about them a bit between now and then. And those are the two questions at the bottom, which I think pose quite rational challenges, or quite radical challenges, excuse me, to these compressionist ideas. Okay? And you may have been thinking of these as I was talking. One of the challenges is whether any type of epistemic efficiency really is a compelling organizational goal of science. Okay, and the second is that it concerns whether the precept of keeping the number of axioms small is really well regarded as representing a concern for efficiency. Okay? Now, those are two big ways I could really go wrong, and anybody could go wrong in taking this compression stuff too seriously. All right. So let's see. Let's look at that first question a little more carefully. All right. The idea is basically this. Why should I care about efficiency? Well, I care about efficiency for one of two reasons. Either because resources to do what I want to do are scarce. They don't grow on trees. And so I only get so much of it, I've really got to make it count. Okay, so scarcity of basic resources is one. And the other one really a very different sort of consideration. It has to do with a kind of scarcity, but a kind of self-created scarcity. Okay. One thing I have to worry about when I'm trying to manage resources is using up the resources before I've done what I want to do. That is to say, that's something I have to worry about if the resources are depletable. Okay. So I'm concerned about efficiency when resources can be scarce and when they're depletable. Query. Is justification or rudimentary justification like that? Is it scarce? Well, it might be. And it might be scarcity that would be the driving force behind efficiency. Is it depletable? Well, that's kind of, I think, a harder question to wrap your mind around. And of course, right away, you're saying, well, that's not really the question. I mean, I don't really care. I know justification is eternal. Plato told me that, right? It lasts forever. But of course, it's depletable in this sense. In order for me to use a piece of evidence to extend my knowledge, I have to do something with it. That means I have to have the resources to do something with it. And those resources might be depletable. Okay, so even if the stuff itself isn't depletable, the justification itself, my ability to put it to some kind of good use might be depletable. All right. And let's see, do I want to say anything more? Yeah, I think I'll just leave it for the next lecture. And there's a summary of the main points that I tried to make today. That's it. Thank you. No, it's not. Yeah, so I don't know enough about the whole history of this to really give you a good answer. I think I know a little bit, so I'll tell you what I think I know. I think the preoccupation with smallness of numbers really didn't begin that way. It began with widespread acceptance in mathematics as well as elsewhere of what I'd call a hierarchical scheme of knowledge organization. Okay, and so you keep trying to generalize and find deeper, higher, whatever you want, whatever the metaphor is, higher, deeper, whatever. Anyway, you're moving out or down a hierarchy, all right? And the idea was that in order for the subsumptions to keep mounting, you were going to have to induce a smaller number of principles. Okay, that's part of what the hierarchical organization was doing. It was diminishing the number of principles. And so there was this correlation, to some extent strained and illogical, but I think nonetheless a correlation between hierarchical penetration of knowledge, which everybody thought was a good thing. Everybody who bought into these hierarchical schemes anyway, thought that was a good thing. And the idea that when you do that, you do decrease the number of basic principles, okay? So I think that's what there was pretty early on. I made some attempt to find serious mentions of a smallness of number of axioms as early as I could, and I've got them into the 18th century. But it just that's not very old, of course, but it does happen there, and it happens with a fair amount of frequency. Well, but of course, the usual view of analysis, Emily, as you well know, is that you can walk both directions on that road. And in fact, it's only because you can walk both directions that you take the analytic walk. All right? I only do analysis so I can ascend to a principle and then do synthesis. And if I can't, if my analytic procedures are such that they don't allow me to do that, or they don't facilitate my doing that, then they're not very good. They're not what I want analytic methods to be. I think that this just pertains to your last remark about that's analysis rather than synthesis. Yeah, it is, but they were a kind of unit, two sides of a coin. Right. Yeah, I've looked, and I haven't found, but 18th century, yes. 17th century, no.
No, I'm not saying that. No. It is the 17th century. I'm just saying it's finding its inspiration in that conception.
Oh, that could be, yeah. Right. So I think one way to read that, one consequence that I think can be reasonably derived from that is that it establishes a limit on compressibility. Okay? But I'm not so interested in that limit. I mean, actually, I have thought about this quite a bit, okay? I'm not so interested in that limit because what you can't compress, according to Gödel's theorem, is a class of truths. All right, so say I can't take the truths of arithmetic and axiomatize them. All right? But that doesn't mean, of course, that I can't axiomatize all kinds of other spaces of propositions. Okay, and so I'm taken by actually the kind of notion of completeness that were around in the late 19th and early 20th century were all examples of what I call descriptive completeness. Here's the kind of completeness you had to have if you were producing a formal axiomatic theory of a given area of mathematics. You had to capture as theorems all known theorems of that field. If you did, your axiomatization was complete. Why? Because you had captured every known truth. You'd captured all the data. That's what theories are responsible to capture, is the data. This is exactly what Russell said. Of course, it's a very non-Gödelian type of notion of completeness, but it certainly was a much more common conception of completeness. I mean, well into the 20th century than Gödel's was. Did that help? Okay. Claudine will identify, yeah.
So do you think that Gödel raises the bar too high because
thinks that a theory should cover all? No, I wouldn't say that necessarily. I'm just saying it's easy to confuse two things. Certainly any theory in any area of science has a responsibility to anything that can count as data. I would say that's its first responsibility as a completeness responsibility, okay? Would it be nice when you've come up with a set of axioms that capture all the data to also have a set of axioms that captures all the truths? Yeah, but really, how would you control that? How would you, well, exactly, but yeah, exactly. How would you control that? I mean, if I don't know all the truths, then I can't design a theory to be Gödelian complete by designing a theory to account for what was known to be true, right? So I think in a way, I mean, Gödelian completeness might be some kind of, I mean, it would be a nice thing, wouldn't it? Even if we couldn't know it, it would probably be a nice thing. Right? Even if I couldn't know a theory was complete, if it really was, it'd be a nice theory. All right, I'm going to say that, knowing I have no danger of ever having it put to the test. So, but I don't think that notion of completeness is nearly as compelling as this notion of descriptive completeness. Jonathan, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just thinking throughout the whole talk, I was thinking about reasoning to best explanation. And I was thinking about physical science. And I was just wondering, you were talking about depletion of resources, and I was thinking, well, time is a very valuable resource. And you may have mentioned that at the beginning. So time is a resource. And when a scientist, for instance, some hypothetical scientist, reasons to explanation. it's obvious that compression has a kind of use already in the practice.
Right.
Yeah. I was wondering if that's an open-ended question.
Yeah. I want to say hear. I mean, I agree with that. What I'm not sure about, though, is whether I'm really right about what compression is. Okay, whether it's really a relation that exists between two justificative strategies as strategies for managing the justification of some set. Okay, is it that? Or is it something else entirely? If it's that, then I'm very comfortable with the view you described. If it's something completely different that doesn't really have to do with, for which there's no practical means of implementation. So in other words, if this connection I queried between compression and axiomatization, if that's not right, then I think I probably will be less interested in compression because I won't have any practical ways to go about getting it, right? I mean, we know something about axiomatization, but I don't think there are not too many strategies you can think of other than, of course, induction that are clearly strategies, justificative strategies that have clear compressional promise. I mean, right? I mean, in some ways, of course, the inductive strategy is even more marvelous than the axiomatic method at that. But if you believe Russell, they're not distinct, right? I mean, the axiomatic method is a regressive method, and that's an inductive method, so. No, I don't mean, okay. I'm not sure what to say about that case. I actually need to think about it. What I meant by implementation was really this. One question Jonathan raised was how compelling an interest compression really is. And I was saying that I would find it a less compelling interest, a less compelling virtue or ideal of science if there wasn't some practical means of implementing it. But I think there is, and I think that's axiomatization, okay? So that's what I meant by implementation, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And to a certain extent, there were some mathematicians at the end of the 19th century who said that the main difference, precisely, between what they expected from mathematical reasoning in comparison with the, sorry, someone like Persney between the corollary of reasoning and theoretic reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that precisely what was interesting was the way you did not compress.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Engaged in processes of validity or justifications.
Yeah.
At least if you think in epistemological terms, you may be a little bit worried by the way you...
Right.
Can you see what I mean?
Right. I mean, knowledge is more than confidence and a strategy.
Yes.
Right. I mean, if I'm going to have knowledge of the product, right, I've got to have confidence in more than the efficiency of the method, okay? Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I introduced so much weird terminology in this talk, I actually went back and edited. There would have been more if I hadn't done this. So I make a distinction between what I call extensive efficiency and operational efficiency. And I say that a justificative plan is extensively efficient if it carries justification to every part of the relevant space, okay? I say that it's operationally effective or efficient if it provides a practical way, if it kind of maximizes average efficiency of getting to the different points, okay? And that's something else. And in fact, I'm wondering whether those are really compatible as aims. I mean, it might be that there's some kind of tension between extensive efficiency and operational efficiency, but I just haven't figured it out. I don't really know how to think about it. But yeah, good question. All right. Well, thank you. It was a nice conversation. I enjoyed it.
I'm expecting the second part of the story on the 20th of October.
Okay.